Sometimes you just got to begin to chase a dream that is bigger than you. Sometimes when it seems like you're so far behind that you'll never catch up, you got to get up on your feet. You can't wait on other people to be what you've been called to be.
Hello and welcome to the Ugly Daughter podcast. This is Julia Legian. Today I am talking to an inspiring and brave 20-year-old young lady. Her name is Maryam Zulfika. She's from the UK. She's a campaigner and a speaker on mental health illness and ending sexual violence, which is something very close to my heart. Hello, Maryam. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Julia. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, hun. I believe you suffered from mental health illness for many years and kept in a psychiatric hospital for a long time. Is it okay for me to ask what happened to you in the past that robbed you of your peace and the will to live?
Of course. It's something I'm very comfortable talking about now because it's something I've overcome now. So I went through some very traumatic things in my childhood. A lot of sexual abuse at the hands of a number of different people, severe bullying, you know. I was pretty young when all of this started happening. And at the time, I thought it was okay. I thought it was normal. I thought everyone went through this. At the time, I didn't even know that there was a right or wrong. And the kind of abuse happened for so long that it manifested into depression at first. So I started feeling low. I remember being quite young and feeling really, really low and thinking about dying. Mm. And at such a tender and young age, that is hardly something you should be thinking about. So over the years, I started feeling very low. I started self-harming. But really, what triggered everything was a flashback for the first time over my lifetime. A lot had happened and I'd suppressed it. Sometimes, some days I'd even forget what had happened. But there was this one time I remember, I was in bed and I had my first proper flashback of the sexual abuse. And it was petrifying. I was paralyzed and I was literally in shock. I couldn't move. I couldn't even think. It was just so painful. and that really triggered my mental health problems. From there on out, I was having nightmares and panic attacks and I was crying all the time. I really lost my will to live, and that was at a pretty young age.
Maryam, I understand how you feel. I was sexually abused at a very young age too, and I did not tell anyone for a long time. I guess we were young and frightened, therefore we did not dare to speak up.
Exactly. Because, you know, they either threaten you, but most people don't realize it's people that are close to you. They're the ones doing the abusing. People think a lot of times it's going to be a stranger in a white van offering you candy. But the reality is, it's more often than not someone in your own home.
Yeah, I agree. Usually they are family members, someone who you're really close to, or someone you really trust.
Exactly.
Sadly, that was in my case.
Yeah. But at the same time, like you said, it happened to you. And yeah, it's happening to so, so, so many other young girls and boys. It's an actual epidemic at this point. And it's been going on for so long. But people don't speak about it because of shame. There is such a stigma attached to being a survivor. I don't understand why. Because 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys go through it. So why aren't there more people speaking out? Why aren't there more voices being heard? Just don't understand.
I can't speak for a million of victims out there, but I can only tell you my own personal experience.
Yeah.
I was extremely young and vulnerable, and I didn't know what to do or who to turn for help. Also, my life was threatened at the time.
Yeah.
But most importantly, I knew that no one would believe my claim because the person that abused me had a great reputation and was a pillar of the community. So who would believe a troublesome little girl? So it's really hard to come out.
Exactly. Especially if you come from an ethnic minority or, that it's even more closeted. Because what will people say? What will people say?
Yeah. Maryam, I read on one of your posts a comment from your doctor, which I thought very disturbing. He told you life isn't for everyone. I wonder, why did he say such thing?
Right, so to give a bit of background as to why I actually went into hospital. So November 2012, I became incredibly suicidal. I had attempted suicide a few times at this point, but never had I been in that much pain to that point in my life. You know, on a Sunday, I went to, in London, we have 99p stores. So I went to my local high street and I went to every Sainsbury, all the supermarkets, all the grocery stores, and I went and bought one pack of paracetamol. Now, in the UK, you can only buy one pack of paracetamol. You can't buy more than one. So I went to all these stores, bought one pack each, because I wouldn't get served otherwise. And then I realized if I'm going to kill myself, and I was under 18 at the time, I was 16, I wouldn't get served razors. They wouldn't sell them to me. So I went on eBay and I bought surgical scalpels, what surgeons use. And on the one, I was still charging be killing myself that Friday. I knew that my family was going to be away. I knew that I'd drawn diagrams of how I was going to do it. It's quite gross not to think about it. So on the Monday, I went in to see my psychologist. At this point, I was seeing a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a family therapist, and an EMDR therapist. So EMDR, that doesn't know, is eye movement desensitization reframing therapy. And that's specific to trauma that helps with PTSD symptoms. So I went in to see my psychologist, and she looked at me, and she asked me how I was doing. And I completely broke down in a way that I'd never actually cried before. And I was on the floor crying so hard. Like, I've been through a lot of painful physical things, you know, been raped. There's so much physical stuff that's happened, so much I've put my body through, you know, overdoses, self-harm, but nothing, even now to this day, describes the pain I felt when I was at that low, where the physical pain of wanting to die and that pain, it was overwhelming. I was on the floor crying and just saying, God, just take me, I can't do this anymore. And even before she asked me how I was doing, my psychologist looked at me, and later on she told me that she knew. She said, my energy, she said something in the room changed the second that I walked in. She said that she knew that if she didn't put me in hospital that day, that this would be the one thing she would regret for the rest of her life. So she came over to me. They're not actually allowed to do this. So she opened my bag and she found all the pills and blades. And she was like, crap, I need to do something now. She asked me if I'd taken an overdose at this point. I'd taken a couple of pills, but I hadn't taken a big overdose. And she got one of the nurses or doctors or someone to come and watch me while she called the hospitals and emergency referrals for me to go into hospital. So I'd had short-term hospital stays before this, but nothing long-term. So when I went into hospital, it was horrible. It was like, I was told I was going to be there for a month. 28 days, they said. They lied.
I'm glad they did.
So they told me I was going to be in there for 28 days. I went in there and I thought that the world was against me. I thought everyone there was going to hurt me. But funny enough, that's actually where I met one of my absolute closest and dearest best friends. But it wasn't easy. I wouldn't be able to sleep for nights. I'd spent all night, like you must have seen on the post where I'm laying on the floor. So I couldn't sleep in my own bed because of flashbacks and nightmares and panic attacks and everything. It was horrible. I would hide blades in my bra into the hospital just so I could self-harm. And even in the hospital, I lost the will to live. I was just making do, doing the bare minimum. I wasn't really sticking to any treatments. I didn't want to take my medicines. I didn't want to do any of it. So this went on for a long time until when I had my weekly meetings with the consultant psychiatrist there. And we sat down and for the first time, I felt like being a bit of a brat. By nature, I'm not a brat. I'm not mean or angry. I don't get angry. I'd never had an argument. I'd never tiff or anything like that. But for some reason, I just felt like being a brat. So I came into the room. Usually, I've always been very responsive. I've always been very approachable, whatnot. So I came in with my arms crossed and I sat down. He asked me how I was doing and I just gave very sarcastic answers. And this is the first time he'd seen that side of me. So he got angry. You know, this went on for a good 10, 15 minutes and he got angry with me and he said, Mia, and this is exactly what he said. And I remember it word for word as if it was yesterday. He said, Mia, you're just like every single girl that's walked into this room. You've been abused. You've been broken. You're either going to spend your life in and out of hospital or you're going to kill yourself. I don't think life is for everyone. And I don't think life is for you. So he said this to me. He told me exactly what I needed to hear, exactly what I wanted to hear. I'd just been waiting for someone to tell me that life wasn't for me. People at this point would be telling me, oh, your life is for everyone, it'll get better. But he turned around and he told me that life isn't for me, which is what I wanted to hear. But I got angry. I got so, so, so angry. And I don't know why I was getting angry. But I remember feeling this red hot anger inside me that I'd never felt before. And I walked out, went into my room and cried. And I really, really cried. He told me exactly what I wanted to hear, but I was angry with him and I was upset. I don't understand this. So I spent hours just sitting there thinking about it. And then it kind of hit me, my aha moment, my first true aha moment in my life.
Yeah.
And it just hit me like a ton of bricks that he didn't say it out of anger or malice. He said it because that's what I wanted to hear. No one had told me that I needed to hear that in order to wake me up.
Yeah.
And the second I realized that he didn't say it out of anger, he said it because life is for me. But just because I've been abused and broken does not mean I have to become a statistic. Like, I can break the cycle and I don't have to spend my life in and out of hospital. I don't have to kill myself. And that life is for me. That was, you know, when I realized that, I spent all night crying again. I'm a big crybaby.
Don't worry, there was one time I cried for 3 days.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of tears gone to waste.
Yeah.
But I spent all night crying and I said to myself, you know, I want more. I want more. And I was 16 at this point and I just didn't know what to do. I wanted to get better. This first time I actually wanted to get better. So the next day I sat back down with him and I said, I'm going to change. I'm going to stick with the medicines. I'm going to stick. And, you know, I stuck with it. I stuck with every therapy they wanted, every meeting with any psychiatrist, psychologist, drama therapy, yeah, color therapy, music therapy, everything. I tried everything, yeah, because for the first time I had a will to live, you know, and not too long after that, despite them telling me I'd been in hospital for a very long time, you know, for another year possibly, I got out of hospital literally months after this conversation because I fought really hard. And, you know, in my view, he didn't say it out of anger or spite. He said it because that's what I needed to hear. And that was my alarm clock. That was what woke me up.
So what can you say or do to help the victims and also to help them ease the pain?
You're not alone. There is light at the end of the tunnel. And right now, the pain, I'm sure it hurts. It's, you can't breathe, you can't eat, you can't sleep, but you're not alone. There's millions of girls out there, millions of boys out there who are going through exactly what you're going through. And one day, someone's going to ask you how you're doing. And when they ask you that, you're going to have to be honest. Because for a long time, no one asked me. No one really asked me how I was doing. But when someone asks you how you're doing and if you're okay, be honest. Because I know we try to hide. We think we're protecting people, but we're not. We're really hurting ourselves.
Do you think people didn't want to ask you because they knew what went on and they chose to ignore it? I know my mother did.
In my case, my parents didn't know. I had to tell them. And this was whilst I was in therapy. You know, it took me 6 months to pluck up the courage to tell my parents what had happened to me. My mum and my stepdad, telling them, I thought that they'd hate me. I thought that they'd disown me, but they were so supportive. They were so supportive and they've been incredibly supportive the entire time. They have never said anything stigmatizing. They've never not believed me. They've always been very supportive. And I know that I'm lucky because not a lot of people get that. Most people don't get that.
Yeah, because it took years to come forward. I remember the first time I told my mother what had happened. She struck me across the face and called me all kinds of terrible names. Then she ordered me to get out of her home. She actually wanted to protect the perpetrator and try to silence me.
You know, when we're in the victim phase, we're told that we don't have a voice, be it by culture, be it by the perpetrator, be it by a family, friends, society. We're told that we don't have a voice. And it's very, very liberating finding a voice. You know, for me, the day I found my voice was the day my life really changed. And that happened as a result of speaking. So when I was 12, I had my first miscarriage. I was laying in the hospital bed and the doctor asked me, the first time anyone had ever asked me, he said, did anyone hurt you? And I remember wanting to say yes. I really wanted to say yes, but my throat closed up and my body went dead. I couldn't speak. Like, I wanted to, but the voice just wouldn't come out. And I said to myself, you know, if anyone asks me that again, I'll be honest. But years later, a few months after I got out of hospital, I started working with a charity around mental health stigma and discrimination. Because I'd faced stigma and discrimination because my school told me they didn't want me there, got kicked out for having mental health problems, blah, blah, blah. But I remember the first time I was going to be speaking in front of a group of people. They were setting up the presentation and I had to deliver my testimony. This is the first time I'd shared my story with a group of people. I remember standing there and I was shaking and I could feel my throat close up like I did that time. But I had a bit of a flashback to 12-year-old me in the hospital bed. Sorry.
It's okay, huh? I understand.
And I said to myself that I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for that 12-year-old girl. And for all of those girls out there who are my position, who, and boys, definitely, who don't have a voice, I'm going to give them a voice. And so the first time I spoke is this voice I didn't even know I had. It just came out of nowhere and it was loud. And I said to myself, no one is going to suppress this voice ever again, ever. And so I didn't. And now I talk about it because we need to talk about it. Like I said, there's no shame in being a survivor. There's no shame in once being a victim. There's so many of us out there. So many of us out there.
I used to feel so ashamed and,
yeah,
and disgusted, yeah, you know, with yourself. But yeah, now, you know, you sit back and you think about it and say, hang on a minute, I, yeah, didn't do all this. You know, someone did it, yeah, to me. I shouldn't be feeling this way.
Exactly. Exactly. The guilt should not be within you. It should be theirs.
That's right.
It's not yours. You didn't do anything wrong. You didn't do anything wrong. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But I guess it's just human nature, Miriam, that we just punish ourselves for something we did not do, which is, you know, sounds so insane.
But you know what? It's funny when you say it. It's funny that you said that because after a while, punishing yourself, you start enjoying it. It becomes a habit. It becomes a habit. Yeah, which is why people who've been abused often get into abusive relationships and why they,
yeah,
why they, you know, start drinking, smoking, why they get into drugs. Because they enjoy the pain and we love it because that's all we know. That's
but
all
Miriam,
we know.
But Miriam, I don't think we really enjoy the pain, but
it's comforting.
Yeah. I know a lot of us causing self-harm because we want to run away from the unbearable emotional pain, yeah, which is far more deadly than anything else.
Yeah. What helped you the most on your journey?
I think it was the moment that I realized that there was absolutely nothing I could do to change the situation. And the best option I had at the time was forgiveness. So I decided to forgive the person. But most importantly, I decided to forgive myself for holding on to the guilt and the shame for so long. And I decided I don't want to be a victim anymore. I want to have a normal and happy life. And the only way, I believe, for me to be able to heal and to move on with my life, to totally accept my past and to forgive and let go of all the pain and the anger.
That is absolutely incredible because mine was and it only happened a few months ago. It's something very new. Like, I did this event with my best friend and it was around, putting the past to bed, essentially. And, you know, it was about one part of it was about stories that we make about ourselves and that shape our view of the world. So all my life, because of what had happened to me as a kid, I'd shaped a story in my head that, yeah, I was bad, I was worthless, and pardon my French, that I was a piece of shit. And everything I did in life was, I saw out of this lens that I was bad, worthless, and a piece, yeah, of whatever. So if I was late for the bus, immediately the first thing that would go through my head is, I'm this. I, you know, did something, this, something bad happened, it's because of me. So at this forum, the leader said, who here has a story in their head about themselves? So I put my hand up, went on stage, didn't know what I was going to say. And he asked me, okay, so what's the story you've made up in your head? I said, the story I've made up in my head is that everyone I meet is going to hurt me. So the first thing I do when I meet anyone, be it family, friends, you know, a significant other, a stranger, is the story. You know, that they're going to hurt me and what barriers can I put up immediately just to prevent them from hurting me? And I'm sure you'll agree that you were afraid of people. You were afraid that everyone is going to hurt you. And it's paralyzing because you're living a life of self-preservation. You're not living a life of fulfillment. Mm. So this is the story I made up in my head. And he said, okay, so where did the story come from? I was like, okay, so this is what happened. And he wanted me to name what had happened in detail. So I'm there telling 148 strangers and my best friend what happened. And it was horrible. And I talk about it on stage all the time, but this was different. And I started saying this. I started naming everyone who'd hurt me. I started forgiving them. I forgive you, X. I forgive you, Y. I forgive you, Z. I forgive you, X. I forgive you, Y. I forgive you, Z. And first, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. But then I kept saying it. And I kept saying it, until I started believing it. And I started to list everyone. And it was a long list. It was a long list. And it hurt. It hurt thinking about them. It hurt naming them. It hurt forgiving them. But I kept doing it. So I felt myself feeling free. And it was bizarre. I remember standing there. Like, I was literally dancing. Everyone was like, you were dancing up there. And I started forgiving them. So I, you know, I felt myself getting free. Literally, I felt a weight. I felt like something was coming out of me. It's bizarre. And I felt like I was pretty much free. Until I got to myself and I realized I had to forgive me. That's the most important person in the world, in my world. So I started saying, I forgive you, Mia. 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 I'm sorry to mean it. And then I don't know what happened, but I felt like I died on stage that day. And something else came about because I felt free. It's kind of because I don't hold any resentment, not at all. And when I looked at those 149 people, feel their hands on me, so much love that I didn't even know I was capable of because I'd forgiven myself. And when you forgive yourself, that's the most profound thing you can do for yourself. You know, that's love, that's acceptance, that's self-love. And it was life-changing and changed my life.
Miriam, I'm glad that you choose to heal yourself and to move on with your life. I'm really grateful that you are sharing your story with us today and also to raise the awareness. Can you talk a little bit about your current work?
My current work? Excellent, yeah. So I do a lot. I train teachers, doctors, psychiatrists on mental health stigma and discrimination. I go into schools and I deliver training on how to do this because our language, the language we use, can be very stigmatizing. You know, if you told a 16-year-old at school who's going through depression to snap out of it, it might do more harm than good, even if your intentions are good, even if your intentions as a teacher are to support them, language makes a big difference. So that's something I do, but I'm also a public speaker and I'm working on a very exciting project. So I'm working on coming out with a mental wellbeing app, an application which focuses on good mental wellbeing. So this will be on your phone because we're on our phones all the time. We're attached to our phones. We live in a mobile age. So this app will be free, it'll be completely downloadable, and it'll be there to support people who might not be feeling that great. It's not people who are in crisis. So if you're having a panic attack or if you're feeling anxious, you go into this app, there will be interactive games, there'll be breathing exercises, there'll be tips and tricks, and they'll signpost you to the relevant services if you needed more help. So it's going to be interactive, it's going to be fun, it's going to be informative, and there's nothing quite like it out there, and we've started working on it, and I'm really looking forward to it, because I think it could make a big difference. But in addition to that, I'm a mental wellbeing coach. I support people and I coach them on how to improve their mental wellbeing. Because ultimately, in order to have good physical health, in order to have a successful business, in order to be successful in your work life, have good relationships, it all starts with the mind and mental wellbeing. It all starts with you.
80% starts with the attitude.
Exactly. Your attitude determines your altitude.
Yep. Sounds very exciting, Miriam.
It's exciting. And, you know, people ask me this all the time, like, how are you so happy? And the reality is I'm not happy all the time. And if you've been through mental health problems, like I have bipolar disorder type 1, it's not always easy. it's not always roses and peonies. A lot of days it's hard to get out of bed. But that's the thing, you have to choose it every day. Every day you wake up, choosing recovery. Every day you wake up, choosing to live. Every day you choose up to make a difference. Every day you have to wake up to follow your why and your purpose. You know, when you find something like you, you know, your podcast and all the fantastic work you do, that's good. And when you've got a strong reason to get out of bed, you'll do anything. The past can't hurt you. The fear, nothing can touch you. It's incredible. It's liberating. When you turn your pain into love, it's incredible, isn't it? When you can share your story from a place of love, it's powerful. You know, I like to say this all the time. I say this to myself every morning, and I'm going to say we, because we survived because the fire inside us burned brighter than the fire around us.
It's wonderful to see you turn your pain into passion and to help others, Miriam. Good on you. What do you want to say to our listeners that choose to hold on to the anger and the pain?
Resentment will kill you. Anger will kill you. Pain will kill you. Choose to not let it kill you, because I can promise you that a fulfilled, happy and loving life after trauma is possible. Like, there is so much suffering and injustice out there, but if you can turn your pain into your purpose, then you should. If you've got a story, you should share it, because there's people out there that need to hear it. There's people out there waiting for you and you don't even know it. There's people out there that need you and you don't even know it. There's millions of people out there who share your story and they need to hear it. They need to know that you're not alone. So share your story. Share your story. Yeah, it's very important to just share your story.
I would also like to encourage the listeners to speak up and don't be afraid to talk about it, because, you know, you have to constantly remind yourself that there are millions of people out there going through it right now.
Do it for us! Do it for Julia and I!
Thank you for your time today. I hope to speak with you again soon.
I'm looking forward to talking to you again. Yeah, you're an incredible woman and what you're doing is very, very inspiring. So thank you for doing what you're doing and sharing our stories. It's important. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening. I'll see you all next week. Bye.